The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week, I gave a talk on the Four Noble Truths, as the custom in the beginning of every year. And I wanted to follow up today, talking more about the Four Noble Truths, partly showing how central it is in the teachings of the Buddha. And in seeing how central it is, perhaps it'll challenge you or prompt you to reflect on how useful and how these four truths are in your life. So the Four Noble Truths are central teachings that are said to be useful teachings or useful practice. Maybe it's more useful to think of the Four Noble Truths as practices than they are as teachings. As teachings, if we think of them as being central religious teachings, people sometimes are predisposed to see them as beliefs, as fundamental principles or tenets of a religion, and then people can get easily confused. But if you see it as practices, then the approach we have to them is very little different. And the Four Noble Truths are useful practices at the beginning of practice, at the middle of practice, and at the end of practice, you know, at the whole range. And the simplest way that I've found to refer to the Four Noble Truths is by restating of them as this way, that if you cling, you will suffer. And if you let go of that clinging, that suffering ceases. So if you cling, if you hold on, if you grip on tight to anything, you will suffer. And if you let go of that clinging, the suffering comes to an end. To state it a little bit more in a traditional way, the Four Noble Truths begin with a problem. And in that they start with a problem, Buddhism starts with recognizing we have a problem, as opposed to a religion that begins with a principle. In that the Four Noble Truths are a practice, they begin with an area that we can engage in and make a difference in, practice with, as opposed to pointing to an area of life that we have to believe, like a tenet of belief or something. And so it starts with a problem that can be addressed. And the problem is traditionally called dukkha, which sometimes in English is called suffering. And then it goes on to the second noble truth and says that there's a cause or a condition from which this problem arises. And that condition, that cause, is thirst or craving. And then it has the good news. And the good news is that all that can cease, can come to an end. The suffering can come to an end, that which the condition which gives rise to it, the clinging can come to an end. So that's good news. It doesn't sound so good because the way it's worded, it just says the truth of cessation, the truth of the end of it all. It doesn't sound celebratory enough. And then the fourth noble truth is the cure or the solution that's offered for the problem. And so here especially it involves a series of practices that we can do that allows the shift and change in our heart and mind so the problem can come to an end, so that the clinging, the grasping, the craving can cease, and so therefore the suffering can cease. And the result of this practice is that there's no more suffering, which stated in positive terms is most often characterized as peace. That somehow the heart, the mind, is at peace with itself, at rest in itself. And peace, profound experience of peace, shouldn't be undervalued in how precious it is, how valuable it is, how satisfying it is. And so this possibility of finally being at rest in ourselves, settled in ourselves in a very peaceful, deep way, is the end result of this path. And so is that enough? Shouldn't there be more to a religious life than just, you know, your neighbors have, you know, they belong to other religions and they have this, you know, their religions have this great lofty beliefs and cosmic dimensions to it and great communion with the deity and great you know, merging with ultimate consciousness. And there's all these lofty, wonderful things that religions promise and point to. And Buddhism doesn't, you know, it's pretty simple. Like if you cling, you should let go. you're not going to get, your neighbors are obviously going to realize how profound this is, how significant this is. So they're going to say, oh, I see. Oh, okay. Well, you know, maybe you'll get the message later. Oh, there's something much more wonderful than that. So this happened to a monk in the time of the Buddha. There was a monk by the name of Sunakata. He was ordained by the Buddha. And he decided to disrobe. He said, enough of this. And he said, you know, the Buddha is not so special after all. And not only is he not so special, but all he teaches is suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path to the end of suffering. That's all. So I'm going to go, because certainly there are more lofty religious goals than that. So and so then someone went to the Buddha and reported this. And when the Buddha heard this, Buddha said, well, this man is misguided. He's angry. And what he said is spoken out of anger. Thinking to discredit the Buddha, he actually praises him. So thinking that by saying that all the Buddha teaches is suffering and the end of suffering, he thinks he's discrediting him, but from the point of view of Buddha, he's praising him. This is really cool. So then, in a different discourse in the same text called the Middle Length Discourse, there's a very interesting discourse, number 112, where it describes the questions you can use to test someone to find out whether they've taken the Four Noble Truths as far as they can go in your life. If a person has really applied the practice of the Four Noble Truths to such a degree that they've really succeeded in uprooting their clinging, so they become free. And this is called someone who's, conventionally in English, we say someone who's enlightened. Sometimes in Buddhism, we say someone who's awakened. The description often is given that someone who has done what had to be done. And done what had to be done here means that what had to be done is the end of suffering. And so someone who succeeds in doing that isn't done what had to be done. So they've succeeded. So the traditional path of Buddhism has an end. The path is only relevant until while you're clinging, while you're suffering, and when you come to an end of suffering, you're not walking the path anymore because you no longer need it. So there are people at the time of who claim to have come to that end. And it happened at the time of the Buddha as well, some of his disciples. And so the Buddha said, someone might come along and claim that I've done what I had to do. If that happens, the Buddha said, neither approve nor disapprove. Without approving or disapproving of what this person says, you should question this person. And you question as follow. So this is interesting. So if you come across someone who says they're enlightened, you can carry these in your pocket, these questions. And it's like the test. So you can start questioning this way. Friend, there are four kinds of expression rightly proclaimed by the Blessed One, by the Buddha, who knows and sees. So four kinds of ways of speaking. What for? Talking about the seen as the seen. Talking about the heard as the heard. Talking about the sensed as the sensed. And talking about the cognized as the cognized. So this is a very simple thing. Something you see, you talk about it as you see it, which is not so usual. Often when we are involved in the world and we perceive something, it's very easy to overlay on top of that a lot of extra stuff. So we overlay on top of that our judgments, our commentary, our desires, our aversions. We don't just see something as it is, but we see it through the filter of what we want, what we don't want, of our conditioning, of our projections, transferences. There's a lot of things that we see that we add on top. And so here, for, expression that's approved by the Buddha is simply is the ability to, when you see something, to see it for what it is, as opposed to seeing it with all the active projections of the mind that goes on top of it. And so this is a fundamental aspect of mindfulness practice. And mindfulness practice is a training to learn to simplify our perceptions enough that we're not overlaying a lot of concepts, ideas on top of what the experience is. So, and then same thing for the heard. When you hear something, you say, you know, this is what I heard. And some of you know that the discourses of the Buddha always begin, thus have I heard. And one of the reasons I believe that it starts this way is that the people are trying to be, they're not saying this is how it is, which is making a statement that maybe they can't, isn't warranted, but things that I've heard this, and I'm going to report what I heard, as opposed to what I believe, or, you know, so you probably, many of you have noticed situations where people kind of, you know, people are playing the game of telephone, where, you know, it's not quite accurate how it's repeated. So then in the sensed, we talk about just what's sensed, in the cognized, just what's cognized. When you have a thought, you see it as a thought. And just let it be that way. So you're walking down the street, and you see someone who looks, it's really, really big. And maybe, you know, muscular or something, I don't know what, big. And so maybe the first time you perceive the person, you perceive the person through your conditioning of what big people mean. Big people mean dangerous people, perhaps. And so you feel some fear. But there's no necessarily any danger in that person. So it's possible to watch in the mind that there's the perception of a person. It's possible to watch, there's a thought arises in the mind, this is a dangerous person. And in seeing that the thought and the person are two different things, to question the thought, to hold the thought more lightly. So, you know, maybe I need to look more carefully. Is a person in fact dangerous or not? But often when people see, their seeing is meshed with their ideas of what they're seeing. And we see often through the filter of our ideas. So some people don't see the difference between the thought that's a dangerous person and this is a dangerous person. And in that, because they're meshed, we have less chance to kind of question and look more deeply and find out what's going on. And probably all of you have been the recipient of something like this, where you did something in the past, maybe something maybe not so nice, and your friends now or your people you know are now seeing you through your past actions, whereas you've already left those past actions behind. You've reformed yourself. And you know, and so you can see they're still holding that in how they see you, as opposed to recognizing, I have this idea about you based on the past. I see you as you are now. Let's try to hold this in a fresh way and explore and question what's going on. So for the Buddha, as someone who's awakened, has the capacity to begin differentiating between what's seen, what's heard, what's sensed, and what's cognized. So each of these domains is seen clearly for itself, as opposed to being meshed together and confused with each other. Does that make some sense, what I'm saying? So given that, so someone who says that they've done what had to be done, someone who says they're awakened, how does that person see regarding these four ways of talking? So that through not clinging, his mind is liberated. They would respond this way. Regarding the seen, I abide unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, with mind rid of barriers. So what's your relationship to the seeing is the question. For someone who's awakened, you ask them, things you see, what's your relationship to them? And the relationship is that you no longer cling to them. And then what's your relationship to what's heard? The same thing is said again. In relationship to what's heard, I abide unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, with a mind rid of barriers, resistance or something. And then it's the same thing about the sensed and the cognized. So why this is significant, I think, is that it's talking about, so the way that someone's going to talk about how they're awakened is not about what they're awakened to in terms of some ultimate truth, some ultimate nature of reality, some ultimate nature of consciousness, some ultimate nature of the cosmos, some ultimate nature of God or the divinity. Now I know the ultimate truth. It's in some ways it's more simple, maybe a little more humble. They're saying that when I see something, I don't cling to it. When I hear something, I don't cling to it. When I think something, I don't cling to it. So what I'm going to underscore here is that it's pointing to the freedom from something as opposed to some metaphysical or great metaphysical principle about reality. You see that difference? So it doesn't say anything about reality or the nature of the mind or the nature of consciousness or the ultimate meaning of life. It doesn't make any big, grand statements. It says, when there's, I think something, I don't cling to it. When I hear something, I don't cling to it. So this, again, echoes back to the Four Noble Truths, where the point of the Four Noble Truths is to learn to become free, to find out how to be free of clinging. And the result of it is this, that when you hear something, you don't get agitated or upset or resistant or worked up. You just hear something. When you think something, you don't get caught by it. You don't get resistant to it. You don't get confused by it or agitated by it. You just have a thought. And the heart, the mind, doesn't get agitated as a result. Is this enough? Is this enough? Or are you going to be like that monk, you know, this Buddhism only teaches, you know, suffering and the end of suffering. Surely there must be more. So then it goes on and says, so you have to question, you should question them further. And so you should question them about what's called the five aggregates. Five aggregates in the ancient India, in a very simple way, and it's not completely accurate, but the way that we identify or get personalize our life or identify, create identity for ourselves is based on five different categories of how we experience ourselves. We can experience our body, we can experience our feelings, we can experience our perceptions of things, we can experience kind of the whole inner mental landscape of mental activity, and we can experience awareness or consciousness. And the ancient Buddhist tradition says that one of these five areas is when people identify, this is who I am, it's in one of those five areas. Some people take their body as be themselves, this is who I am. They spend a lot of time looking in the mirror. Some people, it's their opinions that is who they are. That they hold on to the opinion. Some people, it's their feelings, their level of pleasure and displeasure that they so strongly are attached to. Some people's consciousness that they're attached to. This is who I am. So these five areas. So if someone says that they're awakened, they should. You should ask. What is your relationship to these areas of life? And so then the person should respond this way. In knowing my body. In knowing my body is fading away, fleeting, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of attraction and clinging regarding my body, with the relinquishment of mental opinions, beliefs, and underlying tendencies regarding the body, I have understood that my mind is free. So in relationship to my body, one understands there's none of these forms of clinging. In relationship to feeling, with the destruction fading away, cessation giving up, and relinquishing, to kind of emphasize the importance of this, right? Of just, you know, letting go of clinging by all these different synonyms. Destruction fading away, cessation giving up, and relinquishing. Of attraction and clinging regarding feeling, with the relinquishment of opinions, beliefs, and underlying tendencies in regard to feelings, I know that my mind is liberated. So here again, I want to underscore that it's not saying that in becoming awakened or liberated, you've now understood some principle about reality, metaphysical ultimate principle about the nature of mind, nature of divinity, or the cosmos, or the meaning of life. Here again it says, when you're liberated, what you know is you know that your mind is no longer clinging. So then it goes on further. There's more questions like this. I'll give you one more. So in the ancient world, they had a belief that there are six elements. There's air, water, earth, fire, space, and sometimes that sixth one, I think, it's a little confused myself, but consciousness. Sometimes they list four, sometimes they list six. So then you're supposed to ask, what's your relationship to these six elements? These six... And so then the answer should be, so I'm giving you the answers, right, in case you ever get tested. Friends, the answer should be, I have treated the earth element as not self, with no self based on the earth element. With the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of attraction and clinging based on the earth element, with the giving up of mental opinions, beliefs, and underlying tendencies based on the earth element, I understand my mind is free. So in relationship to each of these elements, a person understands that I'm not going to cling to any of that. I'm not going to resist it. The mind is free in relationship to it. So now I think you get the gist of these questions and the answers, right? The answer is always coming back to not clinging to what's there. It goes on a little bit more like this. It also talks about, in regard to this body with its consciousness and all its ways of experiencing it, eye-making, mind-making, and the underlying tendencies of conceit have been eradicated, come to an end. And how is this done? Then it describes the process by which, the path by which someone eradicates the clinging to self. Because it's one thing not to cling to what you hear, what you think. It's one thing not to cling to, there's many things that we don't cling to, but a very deep, tenacious place of clinging, of holding, because it's so connected to the desire to exist, to survive, is the clinging to conceit, which in this tradition is called the simple feeling of being I am. So it's not conceit in the English way of being better or worse than other people, but that the attachment to just the am-ness. And even that, so it's a very deep feeling. It can feel very beautiful, actually, wonderful, to settle into a simple experience, just am. But even that, in the Buddhist tradition, there's a little bit of attachment to it. So this process, what's the process of becoming free, especially something so subtle as that? So then it describes, in a stereotypic way, a path of practice, where a person first practices ethical practices, lives a ethical life, and then begins to meditate. And learning to meditate, one first begins to put aside the five hindrances, put aside enough being driven by desire, being driven by aversion, being driven by or agitated by agitation, restlessness. You put aside these what's called the five hindrances so that the mind can begin calming down, so the mind can begin getting concentrated. And so then as the mind gets concentrated and still, then it gives us a vantage point from which to see how clinging operates, what we're holding on to. That sometimes it's very hard to see if we're very, you know, agitated or busy or very active. So a year ago, I went up skiing up in the Sierras, and I happened to come back in the midst of a snowstorm. In fact, it was so bad that I think about, I don't know, just a few cars after we went through the checkpoint, they closed the road. And it was so bad that the storm was so strong that I could barely see the taillights of the car in front of me, and sometimes I couldn't see that. We were just creeping along. It was pretty, you know, and the road was icy, and I didn't have chains on my car because the car I was using was four-wheel drive. I thought I didn't need it, but I should have. So, you know, just creeping along. And so, you know, you can imagine that kind of situation where there's cars behind you and cars in front of you and you can't see and the road is slippery and there's wind and, you know, it's like... So I was driving along, and then at some point we managed to get out of it enough. And we got out of it enough, then I noticed, boy, Gil, you're tense. I was kind of like very intensely focused, trying to see what I could see, and I was holding onto the steering wheel really tight. And it wasn't until we came out of some degree of safety that I was so fixated on driving safely, I wasn't noticing how I was when I was driving. And so then I noticed, oh, Gil, you're pretty holding onto the steering wheel pretty tight. You're kind of like, you know, pretty tense with your eyes looking. I think it's safe enough now. I think you can relax. So I relaxed a little bit, you know, didn't grip so hard. And then we kept driving for a while. And after a while, I came to a place where there was no more snow. It wasn't snowing anymore. And the road, you could actually drive on asphalt. And the cars picked up speed, and there was much more distance between cars. They weren't just a few feet apart from each other. And you had to be a few feet apart in the snowstorm because you couldn't see the road. So the only way you could know where to go was to follow the taillights in front of you. And if you didn't see the taillights, you know, you had to keep up. Because if you stopped and they kept going, how are you going to find the road afterwards? It's kind of exciting, right? Anyway, so finally we came to a place where it was asphalt and it wasn't, you know. And then, you know, by that time I wasn't gripping the steering wheel. I wasn't looking so much. But by that time I noticed that I was carrying this more subtle tension deep in my body, kind of leftover, a little bit maybe fear kind of feelings, that I was kind of like, you know, I'd conditioned myself, or kind of this remnant, this leftover kind of little bit anxiety from this was still being held. And it wasn't that easy. The hands on the steering wheel, I could relax. But this deeper holding, you know, didn't just kind of go away like that. I had to breathe and be present and give it time to somehow to unwind. If I had been in the snowstorm, I wouldn't have seen that subtle clinging and holding that was there. Make sense? So the same thing happens. So this is one of the things that happens in meditation. It's not snowstorm necessarily that you're free of. But as we get settled in calmer and calmer meditation, it allows us to see places that we're clinging and holding that are very hard to see in daily life. In fact, they're maybe not even recognizable in daily life. And so so it's kind of like a mixed fortune, you know, to get concentrated and still in meditation. On one hand, it feels very good to have the peace and the calm of meditation. On the other hand, you get to see things that, you know, maybe you wish weren't there. But that's part of the function of it, start seeing the deeper functioning of clinging and holding. And not get sidetracked by philosophy, not get sidetracked by trying to experience some ultimate nature of consciousness or reality or something. But rather to keep the focus on the Four Noble Truths, keep the focus on where's the clinging and can I let go of that clinging? That's the focus. And so one of the things that people cling to is the practice itself. And it's okay to cling to practice. Some people are desperately holding on to practice for dear life, and they need to because their life is so difficult. But luckily, your life maybe is like a snowstorm. But as you get calmer and more settled and settled, then at some point you realize, boy, I'm clinging to the steering wheel of the Dharma. You know, I don't need to do that. I can relax that now as well. I don't have to hold on to practice so tightly. And then you realize maybe that there's deeper levels of clinging. And as you go deeper and deeper, one of the some of the deeper places of clinging that you discover is clinging to self, self-identity, how you want to be seen by people, how you want to see yourself. All the different ideas that we kind of have taken on. Some of them taken on because we've been trained to take them on by how we grew up with our family, perhaps. Some from our life experience, some from our culture. And as what's really nice is that as the mind gets calmer and calmer and more settled, no one has to convince you or argue or give you a great philosophy about why it's important to let go of clinging to self. You don't have to engage in deep philosophical debates about is there a self or is there not a self. You just feel that, you know, it doesn't feel good to have the hands on the steering wheel so tight. You don't need a philosophy to tell you to relax the hands when you're out of the snowstorm. So when you get calm enough, you'll see, you feel, oh, you know, doing this self thing doesn't really serve me. It's kind of like a drag. That's my definition of self. My colloquial is, so what's the self? And my joke definition is, it's wind drag. So at some point, you know, you kind of let go of the wind drag. You pull in. So this process, this course then describes this process. And so all along, the guideline for this is that which helps you get settled enough, calm enough, and have strong enough perception that you begin seeing where the clinging is, and so you can let go. And when you do it all the way, completely, then if you're going to stay true to what the Buddha says, the four forms of expression, in the seeing, you talk about just the seeing, in the heard, just the heard, in the sense, just the sense, in the cognized, just the cognized, then when you're going to describe what has happened to you in the fulfillment of that practice, that path, what you can say is that what happened was I was clinging and now I'm not. There was sounds and I'm not attached to the sounds. They're just sounds. There is perceptions that I have. There's just a perception. I'm not attached to those perceptions. There's thoughts. I have thoughts. There's simple thoughts. They arise. I'm not attached to those thoughts. They float by. They arise and they pass. That you can talk about, because that's something you can see and directly experience. To say, now I've experienced some ultimate reality, some ultimate truth, gets much more challenging. You know, can you really say that? So I'll end with this talk with another discourse from the same book called The Middle Length Discourse. This is Discourse 2. Somewhat famous passage now. It also stresses the value of sticking to the Four Noble Truths as the guideline and support for what this Buddhist practice of liberation is about. It begins by talking about unuseful approaches. If you want to become liberated and free, it's not useful to have these kinds of questions or to consider or explore these kinds of questions. So, was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else one is inwardly perplexed about the present in the following way. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from and where will it go? That's a pretty great list, isn't it? Have you been involved in some of these? Then it goes on and says, when one considers one's life through the vantage point of these questions, tries to answer these questions, one of six viewpoints will occur. So There's six, he claims here, there's six different ways that you can try to answer these kinds of questions. The view that the self exists for me arises in this person as true and established. Or the view that no self exists for me arises in him as arises as true and established. So the idea that no self exists. So many of you have heard that Buddhism seems to say that there's no self, and then you argue about the philosophy, how could that be? But actually here it says that this kind of view that there is no self is also unhelpful result of asking those wrong questions. Or the view, I perceive self with self, arises as true and established. Or the view, I perceive not self with self, arises as true and established. Or the view, I perceive self with not self, arises as true or established. Or else, it is this self of mine that speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions. But this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. So the next passage is interesting. So these speculative views are called a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a vacillation of views, a fetter of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, a person is not free. Is not free from suffering, I say. Elsewhere they talk about it being a quagmire. Once you start trying to understand the nature of self, what is a self, the true self, you can try that, but philosophically, psychologically, phenomenologically, all kinds of ways you try to do that, you'll end up in a quagmire. And so, you read endless books about the nature of the true nature of the self itself, and how philosophers, psychologists these days are trying to find it, and they can't find it. And it's counterintuitive, right? Of course you're here, right? But once you start that route, Buddha says, this is not useful. So then the Buddha says, well, what is useful? What is a useful approach to the path of liberation? If these kinds of questions, these kind of are not useful. This is how, then the Buddha says, this is what's useful. One attends wisely by recognizing this is suffering. One attends wisely by recognizing this is the origin of suffering. One attends wisely, this is the cessation of suffering. One attends wisely, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When one attends wisely in this way, three forms of clinging are abandoned. The clinging to what's called personality view, the clinging to a view about this is who I really am. Doubt about what brings freedom, doubt about what the nature of peace is, how to find it. And then the clinging to, here it's translated as rules and observances. It's literally can be translated as precepts and religious practices. And so, you still might need a steering wheel to drive your car, but after you've come out of the snowstorm, you don't cling to even your religious practices. So, because you realize that clinging to religious practices is not peace. So the Four Noble Truths, over and over and over again, is what, in this ancient teachings of the Buddha, they keep pointing back as the heart of it, the heart of it. The beginning, the middle, and the end. And the heart of this is the value of not clinging, not grasping. Is it enough? Is it good enough? I don't know how you can answer that. But my wish for all of you is that whatever you think is more important than not clinging, do it after you've given up clinging. Yeah. Because, you know, why go through life with a splinter in your foot? Why go through life with suffering? And I think it's a beautifully and profound offering, gift you give to the world, to the degree to which you do this inner work and discover and understand this fundamentally important aspect of human life. The nature of clinging and suffering and our capacity for having a heart that's at peace. Beautifully at peace. Settled at peace. Calmly at peace. Just this. So, thank you very much.